Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has recently completed a very thoughtful and important, well, deep dive into a particularly problematic phase of the recent phase of this war, namely the U.S. involvement in and catalyzing conflict with Libya and Syria, is our guest for this full hour. His name is John Rossomondo. John is a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, where he serves as our senior analyst for defense policy. Previously, John was a senior analyst for counterterrorism at the highly regarded Investigative Project on Terrorism. He is the author, most recently, of The Arab Ruse: How the Muslim Brotherhood Duped Washington in Libya and Syria. John, congratulations on the publication of this new book by the Center for Security Policy Press. We're very proud of it and glad to have you with us to discuss it. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Frank.
Before we get into what the Muslim Brotherhood did that got us embroiled in these very, very, I think, unfortunate conflicts in two North African, Middle Eastern countries, I want to talk to you a little bit about the Muslim Brotherhood, John. It's a group that I think our audience is familiar with, but give us your sense of the nature of this organization, its genesis, and its mission.
The Muslim Brotherhood was founded in 1928 by Hassan al-Banna, who was an Egyptian school teacher, at least at the way his bio refers to him, with the idea of restoring the Islamic Caliphate. The Caliphate was the Islamic Empire that existed from the time of Muhammad all the way until 1924, when it was abolished by Kemal Mustafa, the founder of the Turkish Republic. And they exist to this day in multiple countries. They either work overtly through parliaments or covertly, like they do mostly in the United States, where they deny that they're who they are, who they say they are. They rely on subversive activities, or also they rely on violence. There's an interesting email that was sent by Jake Sullivan, or Sidney Blumenthal, to Hillary Clinton, that stated the direct high-level ties between al-Qaeda and the Brotherhood in April of 2011. So they knew who they were playing ball with.
Let me ask you, though, there was, during the Obama years, a director of national intelligence by the name of James Clapper, who testified before the Congress that the Muslim Brotherhood had, quote, eschewed violence, unquote. And yet, John, as you know, a document found in a Muslim Brotherhood safe house in the outskirts of Washington, D.C., revealed that the goal of the Brotherhood was destroying Western civilization from within, as they put it, by their own hands, meaning ours. That suggests certainly the possibility of violence, as well as this sort of stealth jihad, as Robert Spencer calls it. What's your understanding of the willingness of the brothers to use violence where it's practicable, even if they sensibly decide to eschew it, or at least defer it when it's not?
Well, the way that the Brotherhood works, especially in the Middle East, is that they were a dictatorship. They will use violence to overthrow dictators, as in the case of Gaddafi or in Syria against Assad. But in the United States, they figured out that they could work through the political system by subverting the political system. And, back in 89, you had this book on Dawah, which is Islamic evangelism, essentially. It talked about getting people like Ilhan Omar elected, and by using the political system to their advantage, which, 25 years later, got them working to get the Obama administration involved in Libya and Syria, to bring about their caliphate. I mean, a lot of the Brotherhood leaders like Hassan al-Arian weren't shy of talking in the Arabic press about their desire to finally get their caliphate.
Yeah, we're looking at sort of a long-term program. And the fact that the brothers are present in the United States would probably be news to most Americans. John, give us just a flavor before we get into some of the details of how they operated to influence American policy towards Libya and Syria. Drawing on, I know, your lengthy experience with Steve Emerson and his team at the Investigative Project on Terror, you all have, I think, done as much as anybody to document the extraordinary degree to which the Brotherhood has established infrastructure in this country, including mosques and Islamic societies and centers all over our country, and uses those as sort of vehicles to run influence operations, among other things.
Well, the Muslim Brotherhood established the Muslim Students Association back in the 1960s, and every single Muslim Brotherhood legacy organization flows out of that. Whether the Islamic Society of North America, which they created in 1981, the International Islamic Institute for Islamic Thought, which was the which is the Brotherhood's main think tank, and the National Association of Islamic Thought, and Muslim American Association, etc. The Brotherhood, front groups and Brotherhood organizations. And one of their flagship mosque is a place called the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center outside of Washington, D.C., from which most of these operations that targeted the Obama administration took place. I mean, I documented the fact that Issam Omesh, who's the longtime president of the organization, also a former president of the Muslim American Society, posted pictures of Libyan jihadists on his Facebook page back in last year. And, he was a main person who had access to Samantha Power. He had access to Obama himself. So that's the degree of penetration.
And John, remind us of who was the imam of that mosque for some time, which speaks to this point we touched on a moment ago about the willingness of brothers to use violence where they think they can get away with it.
Well, the head of the mosque was Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an al-Qaeda leader, who was actually undertailed by the FBI in the lead up to 9/11 and some of the declassified information seems to show that he may have been a little bit more involved in supporting the hijackers than previously announced. And Mr. Omesh is the person who hired him to be the imam of Dar al-Hijra. And the Dar al-Hijra, from what I can tell, is ground zero for their influence operation.
Interestingly, roughly the same time the FBI was taking an interest in Anwar al-Awlaki, he was, among other things, leading prayer breakfasts in the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill, considered to be a moderate Muslim with whom the government of the United States could safely engage in outreach. And John, this is, as you know, part of the Brotherhood's false narrative that they can be relied upon as an alternative to the violent jihadists or the immoderate Muslims. And yet their agenda is essentially the same. If it's not sort of Sharia supremacism is what I call it, but their techniques for advancing it, especially in a country like ours, where power rests with those who would oppose that overt agenda, is just more, shall we say, subtle, nuanced, stealthy, rather than the overt, violent kind.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the way that they work. I mean, a guy by the name of Abdurrahman al-Mahdi was a major force in creating this outreach. I met him after 9/11. But they take advantage of the naivete and ignorance of the people they deal with. I mean, al-Mahdi was a very charming individual. I mean, I met him like 3 days after 9/11, after somebody threw a brick through the front window of the Old Town Islamic Bookstore in Alexandria, Virginia. And, you know, he was like, oh, well, compared, you know, the Palestinians to like the IRA, all this other stuff, just try to downplay it. You know, they even had a press conference about 2 weeks after 9/11 at the National Press Club, in which they condemned 9/11, in which they said, you know, Muslims can, through their Fiqh Council of North America, participate in fighting against the Taliban, etc. But, you know, they use things like that to cover what they're really doing behind the scenes, which is mostly in the United States, was fundraising through a network of NGOs for you know, jihadist organizations.
Like non-governmental organizations.
Yeah, Islamic Arab Relief Agency and other things. I mean, that we've been able to, what we found, that the FBI found after 9/11 was supporting Al-Qaeda. So, you know, they'll be like, well, we're against Al-Qaeda up front, but it's just a ruse. Behind the scenes, you know, they're providing money and they're providing aids. I'll give you a specific name. I like dealing in specifics. You have a guy by the name of Abdul-Majid al-Zindani. He was especially designated terrorist by the U.S. and the United Nations, who was involved in supporting Osama bin Laden's financing of al-Qaeda. And he was a close associate of Zindani's. Well, if you look at the Council on American and Islamic Relations, its former leader, one of its former leaders, went and posted a video by Mr. Al-Zindani on his Facebook page a few years ago, Mr. Manji Dawadi. So, you know, these people are great at being liars. They act like the communists in a lot of ways because the communists often will set up front groups. Now, we're talking about justice, peace, and so forth. That hides what they're really up to.
In fact, it really is just totalitarianism of a different stripe, I think, advancing the Islamic supremacist agenda rather than the communist supremacist agenda. But as you say, John, in some cases, at least using very similar techniques. I would just note, you mentioned this fellow talking about specifics, Abdurrahman al-Mahdi, with whom you met after 9/11. The last time I checked, he's doing hard time in federal prison on terrorism charges. So it is, I think, an example of this deceptiveness on the one hand, but also this willingness on the part of the Brotherhood operatives to engage in violence if they think they can do so with effect. John, this brings me to the Obama administration, in which a number of these people, as you've indicated, not only were engaged in influence operations from Dar al-Hijra Mosque and elsewhere, and these various front groups, but were actually inside the wire of the administration in either advisory roles or in some cases as employees of the Obama-Biden team. A couple of examples of those are ones that I've spent a lot of time on over the years, Muhammad Majid, the imam of another prominent mosque in the Washington area. Another is Muhammad Elebiari, a brother based in Texas. Another, I believe, is Huma Abedin, who was at Hillary Clinton's right hand, both before and during her time as Secretary of State and afterwards, of course. These are folks who, among other things, were instrumental during the post 9/11 period in affecting how we perceived the nature of Islam, the nature of Sharia, the nature of jihad. And I have the feeling that as we get into the story about how we were duped into getting involved in aiding and abetting their efforts to overthrow governments, friendly governments, more or less, to us in Libya and Syria. These are the sorts of people who were at work inside the administration. And just as an example, John, one of the things that I think is dogging us to this day is the results of their effort, notably that of Muhammad Majid and Muhammad Elebiari and others on the Department of Homeland Security Advisory Committee that came forward with this idea that the threat we had to focus on was not jihadism or Islamists who practiced it, but rather violent extremism. Can you talk a little bit about that gambit and how it obscured really the nature of our adversaries and therefore made it much less likely we could effectively deal with them?
Well, I mean, one of the things that people always talk about, George Soros. I mean, Soros was a major force in creating this task force and in influencing the Department of Homeland Security to sanitize the our training materials of anything about jihad, anything about violence, anything linking Islamic doctrine to terrorism, etc. I mean, the Farhan Akara, who is a leader of Muslim Advocates, which is a group that Soros helped to set up, was essential in getting together different Islamist leaders to pressure John Brennan at the White House. At the time he was Obama's counterterrorism czar, to sanitize training materials of anything that would link the Muslim Brotherhood with terrorism. So as a result, and also Robert Mueller was a major factor in sanitizing the materials too. And we all saw what happened at the FBI. So when you have these individuals and their sympathizers, I mean, the thing about Obama is besides the fact he grew up in Indonesia, which is an Islamic country, he also had a very strong anti-colonial Marxist bent to him. So that's where the Islamists and the neo-Marxists come together, because they all view Western civilization as evil. I mean, and as a result of my fight against jihad, my biggest supporters against it have been Muslims, and who see the Brotherhood as an organization that has done a lot of evil in the name of their religion. And it's kind of interesting, how the Saudis have come around under Mohammed bin Salman against the Brotherhood, and now they want to isolate it.
They do,
Saudi
indeed.
Arabia as a result.
Well, in part because the Brotherhood is a threat to the kingdom, is it not? As it is to the rest of us, I'm afraid. And John, this just the last point. When they were able to move the U.S. government from focusing on Islamism, jihadism, Sharia supremacism, whatever you want to call it, the violence that they perpetrate in order to advance this idea of the triumph of Islam worldwide, they were able to insinuate instead this idea that there were large numbers of people who were violent extremists, as they call them, who seemed to fit a profile very much like what we're being told these days is the composition of the domestic terrorists that our country is awash with, whether they're white supremacists or veterans or, you know, constitutionalists or conservatives or gun owners, what have you, Trump voters most recently. This has been an insidious but very successful manifestation, I would argue, of their influence operation over the years, and something that, if we allow it to persist, is going to continue to enable us only to pursue loyal, law-abiding, and patriotic Americans and ignore people who are here in considerable numbers who are anything but. And by the way, I have the feeling that may include a fair number of Afghan refugees as well. But before we get to that, John, let's talk a bit about the book, Arab Spring Ruse. Talk about how the Brotherhood used the sorts of infrastructure and techniques that you've just described to persuade this administration led by someone who was clearly sympathetic to them, Barack Obama, into engaging on behalf of the Muslim Brotherhood in Libya and Syria.
Well, the Brotherhood went and crafted a narrative saying that they were all about democracy, that they were about freedom. You know, they co-opted the language that Americans have always grown up with and heard. But the thing is, they always have a different, interpretation that most, average people, especially who are like liberals, don't understand nuance. So when they talk about democracy or, the Islamic term, shura, consultation, but they don't go into saying that, we're going to look at our version of the Islamic doctrine, and that's what it's going to describe it. And anybody who doesn't share it is going to be treated as a takfir or an apostate. I mean, they didn't go out and say that. So, like in Libya, the Muslim Brotherhood led the charge along with Al-Qaeda-linked members of the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group to overthrow Gaddafi, starting with the February 17th, 2011 uprising. And a few days later, you had Hassan Ahmesh and the leaders of the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center putting together an organization that they're called the Libyan Emergency Task Force that aimed to get the Obama administration involved in Syria. They created something called the National Transitional Council. One of the clever things the Brotherhood does is they use non-Islamists as their skin. I mean, meaning they're just sort of front. They're nobody. They went into the United Nations and went and fabricated human rights abuses by the Gaddafi regime. I mean, the British government later confirmed that they had made things up. And then they used this, getting the United Nations Human Rights Council to call for sanctions against Gaddafi, to go to Hillary Clinton, to go to Samantha Power, to say that the United States needs to get involved against Gaddafi. And before you knew it, you had a mesh meeting with Samantha Power and so forth. And then the United States and Hillary Clinton calling for the United States and NATO to start bombing Gaddafi and to work for his ouster.
Yeah. So, John, let me just ask you about one other thing that took place somewhere in the mix here. And I understand that it was promulgated, I believe, just 2 weeks or so before this whole Arab Spring uprising took place. And that is a document called Presidential Study Directive 11. And I don't believe that it has been declassified, but I know people who have seen it who attest to the fact that it basically established as a presidential change in policy that we would begin supporting the Muslim Brotherhood rather than these autocrats who were often unsavory characters, to be sure, but more or less aligned with us, especially vis-a-vis the jihadist in their populations who were threats as they perceived it to them as well as to us?
Well, PSD-11 was presidential study directive that was crafted in the fall of 2010 by Ben Rhodes, Samantha Power, and others that called for a shift in U.S. policy from supporting people like Hosni Mubarak to Muammar Gaddafi to supporting quote-unquote democracy. And that, by democracy, that meant including these Islamists. They had some academic theorists who said, no, if we support the Brotherhood, that all of a sudden they're going to become a firewall against people joining Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda people will see the light because, you know, they're being included in government. They're not being, quote unquote, oppressed by the dictators, et cetera. And before you knew it, you ended up having the uprising against Gaddafi, the uprising against Mubarak in Egypt, which started out actually as a movement that was started by liberals who weren't Islamists. But the fact that the liberals were divided allowed the Islamists to outflank them.
Yeah. And the Muslim Brotherhood in every case, I think, is better organized, is more disciplined, and considerably more ruthless than the liberals and others. And as a result, I think in every case, it quickly came to the fore, notably in Egypt, where it accomplished both the overthrow of the government and came to power itself. And John, when you saw this playing out, the cumulative effect of these influence operations by the brothers here. Is it any surprise, really, that what resulted was an American government alignment with people who actually are deeply hostile to the United States and you know, its interests as they've long been understood, both in the region and beyond?
Well, it's not it's not unsurprising when you look at the ideological orientation of the people of the Obama administration, which were profoundly anti-American. I mean, we ended up supporting people like Ahrar al-Sham, which is the Syrian Taliban, to an extent. And militias that were aligned with al-Qaeda under the banner of the Free Syrian Army, we gave them training, arms that ended up in the hands of al-Qaeda and ISIS. I mean, a lot of these Free Syrian Army brigades broke off and joined ISIS. So this entire thing from the get-go was by a bunch of people who were either anti-American or just plain ignorant about what they were doing.
And tragically, quite a number of them are back in the Biden administration. I think you've identified Tony Blinken, Susan Rice, Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, Bill Burns, the Central Intelligence Agency Director. Again, you mentioned Samantha Power a moment ago, previously the UN ambassador, now running USAID. These are people whose records are really appalling, especially with respect to this particular fiasco in the Arab Spring context, John. And talk a little bit about the extent to which you sort of alluded to it a moment ago. This fellow Sidney Blumenthal and his emails with Hillary Clinton, where I know a source for your book. But describe, if you would, John, the degree to which the administration, certainly at the Hillary Clinton level, and were aware that these brotherhood types were actually involved with the jihadi, out-and-out jihadi elements like Al-Qaeda and ultimately ISIS.
Well, I found an email from now National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan to Hillary Clinton in which he talks about a man by the name of Ali Salibi, who he identifies as Yusuf al-Qaradawi, the Brotherhood ideologue's man in Libya. But he also notes the fact that Salibi and those around him were involved with al-Qaeda during the time of the uprising against Gaddafi in April, March of 2011. So they knew who they were in dealing with. I mean, they knew that they were involved. I mean, I have a source who told me that the source for this information was a guy by the name of Musa Kusa, who had been Gaddafi's chief of intelligence. So they knew what they were dealing with, and they did it anyways.
And to what end, John? Just give us a quick assessment of what we wound up doing as a result of this marriage, if you will, with the Muslim Brotherhood, being duped to some extent, but willfully blind maybe as well. And what is the legacy for the countries involved?
Well, the legacy is that both Libya and Syria remained in the state of civil war 10 years later. And also, you have Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who is the
Turkey
most powerful, influential Brotherhood leader in the world, using his intelligence services and a private military company that's close to him, managing some of this jihadist activities and so forth, and Erdogan is now friendly with the Taliban, etc. And all because of Russophobia, fear of whatever the Russians would do, we're not going to hold Turkey accountable, because a lot of these people are like more worried about what Putin will do than the fact that our NATO ally is supporting terrorism.
In addition to the devastating impact of these incursions on the one hand, the civil wars that they've spawned, we've had this unmistakable windfall accruing to the very person that you say these administration types, Obama, now Biden, are preoccupied with, namely Vladimir Putin. Talk about Russia's success in parlaying the chaos that the Brotherhood helped induce with U.S. government support into the deepest penetration of the Middle East since they were thrown out of Egypt back in, as I recall, 1967.
Well, as a result of the Obama administration's work with the Brotherhood to create the Free Syrian Army in conjunction with Qatar and Turkey, and they ended up creating a vacuum in which they let Vladimir Putin move his army into Syria and shore up Assad. I mean, Assad is basically Putin's puppet now. So he made Russia great again. I mean, as a result of this, and it's just kind of comical how they accuse President Trump of being a puppet of Putin, when everything that the Democrats have done for the past decade has been to increase the power and the prestige of Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, and the ability to translate all of that into geostrategic advantage as well in the Eastern Mediterranean, notably, but I believe elsewhere in the Middle East as well, perhaps even back in Egypt itself, irony of ironies. And John, I guess this brings us to the present moment. We not only have these debacles ongoing in Libya and Syria and to varying degrees elsewhere in the Middle East. We've had this epic and humiliating defeat of the United States at the hands of some of these same people to the unmistakable benefit of Sharia supremacists, notably the Taliban, of course, but through it, in the safe haven for jihadism that they've created, thanks to our defeat, for Al-Qaeda, for ISIS, for ISIS-K, whatever that is, for the Haqqani network, and presumably for others. There are reports, for example, we talked about it on the show yesterday with Robert Spencer, that some of that immense windfall of American military equipment left behind in Afghanistan has now been handed over by the Taliban to jihadists in Tajikistan. And my guess is that it will redound to the benefit of jihadists elsewhere, certainly in a psychological sense. But talk a little bit about that, John.
I've been talking with Afghan sources, and they're saying that they're seeing Al-Qaeda returning from Syria, which we created, to Afghanistan. Most of the fighters along the Afghan side of the border with Tajikistan are Al-Qaeda types. And the Taliban is once again using Al-Qaeda as its shock troops. And we abandoned the National Resistance Front, which had been the Northern Alliance. That was our militia that we used against the Soviets in the 1980s and against the Taliban in the 1990s. They're on their own now because of this administration. I mean, it's just kind of telling, when talking about the Brotherhood and the Taliban, after the Taliban were ousted our government there, this group called the International Union of Muslim Scholars, which is the Brotherhood's most influential international group, praised the Taliban. I mean, these people support the Taliban and have similar ideological goals, et cetera. And it's kind of interesting that the same people who helped to overthrow the governments in Libya and Egypt a decade ago are back in force, supporting the same people who gave us 9/11.
Indeed. Our guest again is John Rossomondo. He is a senior analyst for defense policy at the Center for Security Policy and the author of The Arab Spring Ruse, How the Muslim Brotherhood Duped Washington in Libya and Syria. And John, when you describe what the consequences are of this defeat in Afghanistan, I assume you would agree that the psychological impact, in addition to the material and physical one, for jihadists worldwide, is another and arguably vastly more ominous repercussion of the disastrous policies the Biden team has pursued. Do you agree, John, that every Sharia supremacist in the world is now redoubling their efforts, emboldened, legitimated, encouraged by what they've seen done to us at the hands of the Taliban?
Of course they are. I mean, the thing you have to realize is up until we ousted we let the Taliban take down Afghanistan, the jihadists around the world were kind of, aimless, goalless. I mean, you had some uprisings in Africa that had been going on, but they had been deflated and they had become, less relevant as a result of 4 years of Donald Trump. And it's kind of interesting. Every time you have a Democratic president, the jihadists come up in force. So it's just
back in
really ironic.
Yeah. Well, it's more than ironic. It's very telling, and it's very, as I say, ominous as well. Let me ask you about, John, one of the other possible repercussions of all of this, and that is coming back to the home front. We have, as you know, admitted tens of thousands of Afghan so-called refugees, many of them unaccompanied military age men who we cannot vet, haven't to date, and cannot, as a practical matter, vet. John, knowing these jihadis as you do, having studied them closely and worked on how they think and how they behave under circumstances like this, is it reasonable to expect that we will find in their midst people who will engage in the violent jihad inside the United States when the opportunity presents itself?
Well, I think that it's highly likely. When you look at the Zarnaevs from Chechnya, which was a jihadi hotspot. You look at Saifullah from Uzbekistan. That country had a Islamist jihadist connection. It wouldn't be surprise me if the Taliban seeded the refugee flow with sleeper cells that they could activate when they feel that they need to do so. This isn't fear mongering. I mean, ISIS and Al Qaeda get it, so I don't see any reason why the Taliban would.
And John, to tie this back into what we discussed earlier, to the extent that we saw in connection with the 9/11 attacks, these sorts of jihadis taking advantage of some of that Muslim Brotherhood mosque infrastructure to gain, temporary housing, support, other kinds of assistance, logistical and otherwise. Would you anticipate that were there to be individuals or maybe even cells coming out of this Afghan refugee flow, that they may well find similar kinds of support from Brotherhood front groups and mosques?
Well, I don't want to speculate. One of the things that we've seen since 9/11 is that the jihadists have gotten smarter, as opposed to the corporate top-down kind of activities we saw in 9/11. They've morphed into individual jihad, where they act independently and
these are the so-called
lone wolves. Or activate. Yeah, well, they're individual jihad, and they'll act when they're activated. So, now with the advent of more sophisticated internet communications and so forth, they only need to, say, communicate over signal or something like that to be activated. So I don't want to speculate about what the Muslim Brotherhood network in this country might do, but I would say that you might have some people who are among them who could be planning to engage in terrorist activities like we saw in the Obama years. It's kind of interesting how all of those lone wolf jihadis disappeared as soon as Donald Trump became president, with the exception of one attack.
I don't know that they disappeared, but they laid low, more or less, that's for sure. John, this brings me back to the domestic terrorism front. We are now told that the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI are working on the premise that the most serious national security threat to the United States, internal to the United States, arises from the sorts of people I mentioned a moment ago, conservatives, constitutionalists, Trump voters, white supremacists, as they've been called by some. Does that likely intensify the risk that we're not going to be tracking, monitoring, let alone countering these Sharia supremacists, if in fact, whether as a result of the numbers that have been brought in by the Biden administration through this so-called Afghan refugee project, or for that matter, heavens only knows how many may be coming over our southern border, which is essentially open, as you're very well aware. We're seeing not only the increase in the potential numbers of threats internal to the country, but we're also seeing the diversion of our services that are supposed to protect us against such threats to other, I would argue, non-threats, compounding the danger. Would you agree?
I definitely would agree. I mean, the way this administration defines terrorism is anybody who is opposed to their far left wing extremist agenda. I mean, now look at what you have with the parents protesting critical race theory. They're no longer protesters defended under the First Amendment. They are now labeled as terrorists, and Merrick Garland has decided to send the FBI after them. So we have evolved in our view of terrorism from trying to defend Americans against these extremists from abroad to being like in the third world where you label your political opponents terrorists.
Well, and again, I think this does have its roots in this earlier deflection by the Brotherhood during the Obama years from jihad to so-called violent extremism. And it's just, reaching its natural endpoint, which is the enemy is us, at least some of us. And as you say, it's principally political critics, if not actual opponents of the Obama-Biden agenda and what it's doing to our country. John, let me conclude with this last question. You've written a piece recently about the need for accountability on the part of the general officers who helped shape and dismally execute the administration's Afghan policy. There doesn't seem to be a whole lot of accountability at the moment, certainly not from Joe Biden. But walk us through the importance of that happening and what are the implications if it does not?
Well, one of the things that I was talking with a retired admiral about how do we hold general officers and the admirals accountable? Because right now they feel invulnerable. They don't get fired. So you have people like General Austin who fall up the chain of command because of who they're backslapping. In Austin's case, he was friends with Bo Biden, which made him friends with Joe Biden. So it's become who you're friends with and so forth. And I think that Congress needs to get involved and make it the people who are, say, maybe combat commanders and deputy commanders subject to periodic performance reviews and retention. So if they were to decide, I realized that if they didn't perform up to what they're expected to do, that they were out, it might make them think twice about certain courses of action, because right now I'm looking at the fact that the Pentagon won't do anything about them. The administration won't do anything about them. But, if we end up with a Republican Senate in 2023, then maybe they might want to do something like that. I mean, I look back to World War II, where George Marshall had what he called a plucking committee of former officers who went through all the generals and the colonels and fired over 100 of them. We need that now.
John, I don't know about a plucking committee, but I do know that accountability is absolutely required and that we are going to confront the cumulative effects of personnel decisions that were made by the Biden administration, to some extent, those of the Trump administration, as a result of those promoted by the Biden folks pulling along their mentees, the people that they've sponsored. And then, of course, now back in the Biden years, those sorts of folks all being promoted further. And you follow closely what's happening to the Pentagon, what's happening to our armed forces, what the implications are if good order and discipline, if confidence in their leadership, if policies that are detrimental to the willingness to serve in our military are not changed, are not fixed, we're likely to find ourselves vastly less prepared to deter, let alone defeat, the various enemies that are now unfortunately sensing they have a window of opportunity to operate against us. John Rossomondo, congratulations again on your very important new book, the Arab Spring Ruse and the story that it lays out of how the Muslim Brotherhood duped Washington in Libya and Syria, and I would argue more generally throughout the Obama years and now under many of the same people in the Biden administration. I know you keep up the good work at the Center for Security Policy, and I look forward to having you back to discuss it with us in the near future. Thank you for your time today and for this very informative visit about the past, yes, but also where we find ourselves today and we'll find ourselves tomorrow if we don't learn lessons from the Arab Spring Ruse. Thank you to all of you for listening. I hope you'll come back for more tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Xi Van Fleet is a remarkable and very courageous woman. I had a chance to interview Xi recently about her experience as a child survivor of Mao Zedong's Cultural Revolution in communist China. She warns that so-called critical race theory is a variant on the Marxist-Maoist class warfare technique for dividing and oppressing populations. Ms. Van Fleet came to national attention when she presented this insight to Virginia's Loudoun County School Board. Her warning is all the more compelling now that Attorney General Merrick Garland has told the Justice Department and FBI to treat people like her as, quote, potential domestic terrorists, unquote. In other words, if you oppose the use of a devastatingly effective communist practice aimed at indoctrinating children and adults, destroying individuals and families, and subverting entire nations, the Biden administration now considers you a public enemy. That's un-American and completely unacceptable. This is Frank Gaffney.
All in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you and Rich Higgins.